Okay, so we are pseudo unstructured from here on out, which, if you are opportunistic, gives you the opportunity to get a lot of your specific questions addressed. Yes? We were formerly going to be reviewing specific types of crops, root crops versus leaf crops versus fruit crops versus perennial crops and their various needs in season. The biggest problem with that is that they all need the same basic things to function well. So I don't think we need to spend 3 hours saying that. We can, I think, focus on what your specific issues are in your crops, and if you've got, you know, nuanced questions, we can address them. John's on a conference call for the next half hour, so you can save the hard questions for him. All right. Do you want to start with these things that people have written down? We can just sort of bust through them.
Yeah.
I got three requests during lunch for people who were asking questions. Well, the first request was to get you a mic, which we can't do unless you want to walk down here. So if you're asking a question, you have to be willing to stand up and project your voice. Okay? Or come down and get a microphone. Yes. For those who are shy. It's actually much worse to talk through a microphone than it is to just project. All right. If you forgot to write something, between now and 5:30, we're going to have a 15-minute break, and the rest of the time is devoted to people's questions. And there's also a lot of wisdom in the audience. You know, what are we totally? Our age is less than probably a number of you guys in here. So I feel oftentimes quite self-conscious about that, and girls. But it is what it is. So if people feel like they have something to offer, don't be shy about raising your hand and offering your wisdom. Okay? Adding organic matter in three ways, benefits, details. This is a question about John's presentation yesterday, talking about bringing in organic matter and is that, yes? Who wrote this question? It says, adding organic matter in the three ways, benefits, details. I think the discussion was about cover cropping and composting and humates and carbon induction. So you can bring in humates that have been dug up from underground. Everybody knows what humates are? Humates, okay. Feel free to ask questions. What is a humate? Humates are dug up out of the ground. They come from the layer between peat moss and coal. If you think about it, there has to be something between peat moss and coal. They're the same basic thing that just got compressed for longer and under more pressure. So humates have generally 85 to 90+% humus, which is a very stable organic molecule, which is what makes your soil turn dark colored, which is what you really want. You want a rich, dark soil that connotes a number of very valuable benefits. And humates are dug up out of the ground when they're clearing off a mountain in West Virginia to get the coal. They, you know, shove off a few hundred million tons of humates into the river bottom. That's what they're pushing off in many cases. After they've gotten the subsoil, they get down to the humates, they push that all off, and then they get down to the coal, right? So that's what humates are. You can buy them by the bag, you can buy them by the ton, you can buy them by the dump truck load. They are very good at buffering things. I strongly recommend people use them when they're applying trace elements, whether dry or liquid. They, you know, are a really nice material and you know, have certain purposes. So that's one way you can bring in things. You can make biochar out of wood by burning it not in the presence of oxygen. You can bring in compost. You can cover crop. What John was talking about being the most efficient way to build soil carbon is through having a high level of photosynthetic activity in the leaf, which correlates with lots of sugar being dropped into the soil to feed the soil life, which correlates with the soil life growing, reproducing, dying, roots growing, dying, and all that activity in life, when it dies, becomes, you know, carbon in the soil. And if you've got a functional fungal ecosystem, it will digest that carbon and turn it into humus. So the suggestion was that was the most strategic way to do it, but there's other ways also. Of humates, I would have a hard time saying that there's any number that's too much. Usually, as much as you can afford is going to be beneficial. They have a number of interesting benefits as far as establishing those root lines of soil life that John was talking about, those few hundred lines instead of the few million lines. A lot of those come out of humates. They do some really interesting things. They're very valuable. People who don't like things being dug up out of the ground and moved in trucks don't like humates. I respect that. I don't think it's the most efficient way to build soil carbon. I think the most efficient way is through photosynthetic activity and humification through a functioning biological ecosystem. Yeah. He said you can do too much humates if you have a low pH. If you have a low pH, did we discuss pH here? We didn't discuss pH. Do people want to know what pH actually is? Who knows what pH is? A few people. May I digress? I need a pen. What's that? It's the ratio of hydrogen to hydroxyl ions in the system. This is fine. if you've got HOH, people know what that is? Water, right. So apparently it's ionic. There's a cation and an anion. It's called a hydroxyl and a hydronium. And this is the, what is it? This is a plus, this is a minus. People over here can't see.
Those that have poor vision.
There's space in the front. OH and H and pH. So, in a pH of 7, we have a 1-to-1 relationship between the hydroxyl and hydronium ions. In a pH of 6, we have a 1-to-10 ratio. In a pH of 9, we have 100-to-1. It's the ratio, the relationship, was the inverse logarithm of the hydronium to hydroxyl ion. It's a logarithmic scale. It's like the Richter scale. So, 9 is 10 times as much as 8, which is 10 times as much as 7. But all it's telling you is what's the level of H's to OH's in the soil. Are there more H's or more OH's, or are they evenly balanced? And why is that important? In most situations, to my understanding, you got your soil colloid, you got a sand particle here with a calcium attached. This is a sand particle, but we can have a sand. Sand is not much attaches to sand, right? It doesn't have much bonding sites.
I see.
Clay has lots of bonding sites. Either way, it doesn't matter. When the soil life comes down and solubilizes the calcium and pulls it off to digest and feed up to the plant over time, it replaces it with two hydrogens. That's what happens. When minerals are taken off of the soil colloid, they're replaced with hydrogens. So a low pH soil, an acidic soil, is a soil where all the minerals are gone and they've been replaced with hydrogen. And so you've got more hydrogens than you have hydroxyls, and so your pH drops. Does that make sense? They don't. It's baloney. It's not true. If you're going to ask a question, you have to stand up and project. Well, practice here. So what happens, why do some plants like that? Some plants can function in that environment when other plants can't. A blueberry can function in a low pH when other plants can't. That does not mean it's their optimal environment, they're functional. So rice can function underwater when other plants can't. So an easy way to weed your rice is to flood it, because everything else dies. That's not the best environment for rice to grow in, but it'll live when everything else won't. So blueberries will live in a low pH environment, but they will not flourish in a low pH environment. And John's discussion yesterday of that farmer in Oregon laid that out. He talked about the lowest pH in that soil was 6.2 and everything else was 6.5 to 6.8. And he was getting high levels of antioxidants and great yields and everything else. Great pest and disease resistance. The one point I'd like to make here, if you'll pardon another stick figure plant, it looks like an XY axis. My understanding is that in this area around the root zone called the rhizosphere, where all the soil life is because all the sugar is being exuded, the pH goes up and down all day long in that environment. So even though your soil pH may be 5.4, where there's no life, here it'll be 5 at 6 a.m., and it'll be 7 at 6 p.m., and it'll be 5 again at 6 a.m. the next day. So that the pH in the rhizosphere where the activity is modulating all day long due to the effect of the exudates of the bacteria and the fungi, and they determine the pH in that environment. They're not, they don't have to suffer with it, they create it. So the blueberries may function in a low pH environment, but if you look at the pH around their roots, it's going to be higher because they want to keep it that way. Yes?
So we've all used lime to try to bring the pH.
Yes.
Can you explain to us what that does in the
hydrogen? The lime kicks the hydrogens out. And so you've got less hydrogens in relation to hydroxyls.
So calcium is there instead?
Calcium's bigger. It's a bully. Calcium's bigger, magnesium's next biggest, sodium's next biggest, hydrogen's small. And calcium will kick the hydrogen out in lay terms, functionally. Adding calcium will raise your pH, but it doesn't necessarily address your underlying mineralogical deficiencies. You don't just have a calcium deficiency. You may have a boron and a copper and a zinc and a potassium deficiency also. And so by raising your pH by adding calcium to the soil colloid, you don't necessarily leave space for all the other ones that you also need.
But it's not calcium that does it, it's the carbonate.
Yes. I was trying to do it in lay terms instead of getting into the chemistry. Yes. Adding limestone will change your pH, adding gypsum will not. Yes. Anyway, I just wanted to make a small point on pH. And we've got questions here, and we've got questions in the audience. Fair enough. That's a point well taken. Did everybody hear that? If you have a very low pH soil, because humates themselves have a low pH, it could be a negative effect, at least in the short term, to add a massive quantity of humates to a low pH soil. If you had a low pH soil, I would suggest your first order of priority would be to identify your mineralogical deficiencies and address them, and that would help solve your low pH issue, which would then make you able to spend lots of money on lots of humates later. I mean, 500 pounds an acre is a great dose. A ton an acre, is probably going to be more than you want to afford. 50 pounds, mixed with your trace elements is great.
Can you say one more time about the hydroxyl and the hydrogen and pH?
Sure. 7 is neutral. Yes? Everybody's comfortable with that. 7 is when you've got a one-to-one relationship. No one's standing up to ask their questions. So the soil colloid, my understanding is that, you know, when we take a soil test and we say, oh, I've got, you know, 1,000 pounds of calcium and 200 pounds of magnesium, what they're looking at is what are the, what is the number of minerals that are attached to the soil, not the soil itself. This is your sand particle, this is your clay particle. Your soil test does not measure what's in the clay, what the clay's made out of, or what the sand's made out of. It only measures what's stuck to it. And what's stuck to it is what's relatively available, and the way it works in this, you know, biologically is the bacteria will go down and exude an acid or a base to solubilize or to pull this mineral off of the soil colloid. And because there's two empty charges there, they replace those, they bring in two hydrogens, and two hydrogens come and stick in that spot. And that's functionally the way it happens. And so if you keep pulling minerals out of the soil and replacing them with hydrogens, you have a net effect of a dropping of pH because you have more hydrogens than hydroxyls in your soil. And when you bring into your soil those cations, the calcium and the magnesium and the potassium, et cetera, and they adhere to the soil colloid and kick the hydrogen out, you have a functional increase in your pH. And why is pH considered to be important? Why do people care about pH? Did you notice we didn't talk about pH hardly at all for the first day and a half? And all of our principles and practices. And yet everybody thinks it's so important. Conductivity. Solubility. Because in the conventional agronomic perspective, the soil biology are not involved in the picture. In the conventional agronomic, you know, principles, it's only through solubility and solution that plants have access to minerals. There's no digestive tract, we're living in a test tube. That's conventional fertility, you know, paradigm perspective. And so copper is more soluble at a 6.6 or 6.8 than it is at 5.2. So if you want to have access to copper in that mentality, you must have a 6.6 pH. Does that make sense, in short?
In the case of blueberries in specific, it's really more, I think, about iron availability.
Iron and manganese and phosphorus.
Iron is the first metallic element to lock up at higher pHs and become unavailable. And we've seen many, many times that in substrates that have very high organic matter have much better buffering capacity for all of the elements. So we've actually seen blueberries thrifty in producing excellent fruit at pHs of 7, 2, and 3.
Exactly. Did everybody hear that? When you have a good functioning organic, you know, a good level of organic matter and buffering capacity, he's seen blueberries flourish at 7.2 or 7.3 pH. All right, go back to the list here. Paramagnetism. I'd like to say I understand paramagnetism. I'm actually going to go talk to that guy John was talking about. Remember, he was talking about the microbiologist, the entomologist who studied with Phil Callahan from Florida. I'm going to go see him in Canada next week, and I'm going to go pick his brain about paramagnetism. Phil Callahan was one of those people. You know, we can put him with Tainio and, you know, Steiner and people like that. Really very insightful. Apparently, this guy Tom Dykstra still was Callahan's student and understands it deeply. So I don't think I could do anything really deep on explaining paramagnetism. Shallow? You can interview me. I'll try to write it up and get it out. Yes. Paramagnetism, a paramagnetic material is one whose charges will align in the presence of an applied force. What does that mean? That means that if you've got a magnetic field that, you know, you've got a piece of rock and a magnetic field next to a magnet, that some of the ions in that rock will align along the magnetic field line of the magnet. So the more charges align in that rock, the more paramagnetic it is. And if it's highly paramagnetic, it's probably ferromagnetic. There's a very, very, very interesting correlation between soil paramagnetism and soil, you know, function. So you take a weak soil that just doesn't, you know, it's just tired, it's worn out, it'll have a paramagnetic charge of 25 or 40 or 50. You have a soil that you can put any seed into and it jumps out of the ground and grows vigorously, and it'll have a paramagnetic charge of 300 or 400. And it just correlates very nicely. So carbon and oxygen are both very highly paramagnetic elements, which is interesting because the more aerated your soil is and the more organic material you have in your soil, the more paramagnetic your soil is. Very interesting correlation there. You can get stone dusts that have a paramagnetic charge, and that is a very nice way to increase vigor and vitality in your fields. I like it because of the mineral quotient and the energy quotient. I think it's one of those really nice little secrets that fits in between the cracks. It doesn't cost much. It's a pain in the butt to get it spread, but when you do, things really have a whole new level of vigor. And for anybody who's permaculturally oriented and who wants to be sourcing locally and naturally and, you know, staying out of the mega supply chain, offers a lot of solutions. How's that for shallow? A PCSM meter, which either means paramagnetic charge susceptibility meter or a Phil Callahan soil meter. Either one is the same thing. You can buy them from Pike AgriLab Supply, which is where you can get those bricks presses if you want. It's PIKEAGRI.com.
And if you're curious, you can actually just send a soil sample up to Bob, and he will...
Bob Pike at Pike Agri.
He will use his paramagnetic reader and give you an answer.
They cost like $400. So it's a toy. Yes? High charge. I think you're supposed to stand up and project. I got yelled at for you guys not talking loud, so I'm sorry. Yes. It's a volcanic caldera.
Yeah.
Yep. There's a lot more in there besides iron that's doing interesting things. Paramagnetism is a very interesting thing, and so to complete the paramagnetism point, if a paramagnetic charge is material is one whose charges will align in the presence of an applied field, then you can a highly paramagnetic material will functionally conduct current or charge. And everywhere on the planet, we've got a magnetic field, right? Because if you get out your compass, it's going to go north. So all soil is operating in the presence of an applied field. And functionally, the stronger the magnetic field, the stronger the electrical field. And Arden Anderson likes to say that plants are like electrical appliances plugged into the grid. So your plant, there's a diamagnetic and a paramagnetic, but functionally, the stronger your paramagnetic charge, the larger the space, the energy space that your plant can grow into. So your plants will be bigger functionally because the field is stronger, the energy field. I don't understand these nuances very well. I'm hoping to get more clarity from Tom. It's certainly an interesting component. But Tom Dykstra, he's an entomologist at the University of Florida. I'll keep going until you interrupt. Okay.
Yeah, you had said that, or I think somebody said that we could get paramagnetism from the people that we would get stone dust from.
Yes.
Even like a conventional manure yard.
So where do you get these stone dusts from? If you're looking for stone dusts, in general, we've got this rift here, the Connecticut River Valley, and all the way down, all the way through Connecticut up into Vermont and New Hampshire, you got some really nice deposits of these volcanic materials. Basalts are better than granites. You want a quarry and not a pit, I would say. So if it's a sand pit or a gravel pit, you're going to get less valuable material than if you go to a quarry, where they actually are digging up hard rock. They're probably blasting it, and they're crushing it. And they're crushing it for half-inch stone and three-quarter stone and one-inch stone, and they've got a byproduct, which is powder. stone dust, which is they basically landfill. And they've got, you know, there are hundreds of millions of tons of stone dust that's being landfilled, you know, dumped back in the hole all over the place. And we basically have this available to us. It's already been manufactured. It's a byproduct of industry. It's locally available. They'll give it to you for free or, you know, for the cost of running the loader to fill up a truck. It's really inexpensive. It's local, and it's got all these really interesting attributes.
But they wouldn't be able to tell you the paradigm.
No. No, they have no idea. Was it basalt or granite?
Bleh.
It's hard rock.
But Tom Vanacore, who runs Soil Builders,
yeah,
runs tests on all those rocks.
Tom Vanacore's, you know, he's one of those guys who's got his, you know, he's tuned into rocks. He's a rock guy. Tom Vanacore in Bridport, Vermont, and he has been going all over the Northeast and getting people to send him samples, which he's sending to a prospecting lab in Canada, and getting full mineral assays, so he can tell you, you know, what are the deposits that have been identified in your bioregion that have more vanadium or more chromium or more cobalt or more molybdenum or phosphorus or potassium. I mean, he's got all these, you know, readouts, and he can help you find it. And he's going to charge you a fee for doing it. But for the time being, I think it's a very valuable service.
And you can send him samples.
And you can send him samples, and he'll send them to the lab and get a readout for you. His contact info is in your reader.
Page 35 has a list of a lot of the amendment sources. This is from our fertility recommendations when we do consulting work, and it's certainly not a comprehensive list, but the bottom of that page has at least a dozen organizations that might be of use should you be seeking out fertility amendments.
If your brain's not already stuffed full and you want to go home and do some research, Derek put a bunch of good links together.
So, line is better, drops
better is the way to go. Yep, spin spreaders are a pain in the butt. You can do it, but it's not easy. If you got a sand spreader or a lime spreader, you know, when the ground is frozen and there's no snow, is a perfect time to get trucks out there. 3 to 10 tons per acre. Yep. Yes. You have to be a little bit louder. If you've got a truck coming anyways, you know, if you have a local lime guy that runs for the co-op or whoever runs lime around your area, have them go pick it up in their lime spreader and come and deliver it. They'll charge. It's a really good deal, and it saves you a lot of hassle. Spreading 3 or 4 or 5, 10 tons of stone per acre is, if you want exercise, it's good for you. But otherwise, if you pay somebody a couple $100 to get it, take care of it for you, it's worth the money. Yes. The smaller the particle size, the less you need to use per acre to get, a comparable benefit. So.
Mm-hmm.
When you call a quarry, you want to ask for float or fines. I wrote that in my slides on page 38 or whatever it was, on the stone dust page. I said specifically what to ask for there. So I move on? Okay, more information on perennial crops, asparagus, raspberries, currants, hazelnuts. Who is that? Anybody here? No one wants to take responsibility for that. Okay, so how do you treat perennials systemically as opposed to annuals, because we've been focusing primarily on annuals? I'm of the opinion that the more perennial your crop is, the more important it is to establish a fungal ecosystem for it to flourish. So if you've got a year or a year and a half out and you know you want to plant your permaculture, you know, haven, and you can get a bunch of wood chips, that would be a great place to go spread your wood chips. Not in your garden, but where you're planning on putting in perennials next year or the year after. I think it's very important, everything Derek was talking about this morning with the early childhood stage of the plant has the same effect on the perennials, except has a much longer lasting effect. So if you take your apple seedling and don't give it the good inoculants, and it starts out in a, a media that is not biologically or mineralogically balanced, you're going to have 20 or 30 years of a sick plant instead of 2 or 3 months of a sick plant. So in reality, a lot of the basic management principles are very, very similar, but you have, you know, the costs and the benefits of doing a bad job or a good job early in the plant's life are accentuated. My personal opinion is that's why it's so hard for people to grow organic fruit, tree fruit and things like that, is because that early childhood stage of the plant has been so stressful due to the things that happen to the plants that they really have a really hard time getting their vigor, their vitality, their immunity up, and so they can produce high quality pest and disease resistant crops. Yes? Yes. Great.
Then, when it comes time to actually plant the irrigations, you're actually going to dig a hole in there. So that soil, you then recommend amending that soil, adding inoculants to that soil, and the soil.
All the processes of planting and transplanting are going to be basically exactly the same. You want to inoculate the root, inoculate the hole, put a bunch of goodies in the hole, you know, surround it with a nice fertilizer. Excuse me, this is turned off, but sometimes it doesn't turn off. Yeah, all that basic process of, you know, these are basic minerals that are good. This is you want to get the conductivity up, you want to inoculate the root zone. All that is exactly appropriate and true. One thing about perennials that's very important. My understanding is that when a plant germinates, it sends out its a main root due north. Magnetic north is, you know, you'll see the biggest root that's going out sideways when that plant germinated was going north. And if you don't pay attention and just put that tree in the hole and now its north root is heading southwest, it's dizzy. And it's going to be for the next 20 years. And that it applies to transplants also. All of our plants are you know, operating in an energy field that we are oblivious to because we're so stuck in our heads. But they're all tuned into it, and it's a major part of their reality. So if you do nothing else besides inoculating the seed, the root, and putting some goodies in the hole, aim it north. Aim the major root north. How do you treat the perennials post-harvest? I think John said basically that's when you want to be putting your foliar sprays on. What more specific than that? Yes. What's really, really interesting is that it doesn't really matter whether you're a bacterium or a fungi or a plant or an animal. The same minerals, the copper, the manganese, the zinc, the boron, are all still at the core of the same enzymes that do the same, you know, critical biological things. So all these different organisms, we all have very similar functional, you know, biological processes, and we need the same critical minerals and materials. So, it's you can go a long way with treating everything relatively similarly. Yes, there was a question here about doing the perennials. What do you do with trees that's not after harvest? Where was that? Doesn't really matter. there was one over here that said, you know, John said the best time to feed a fruit tree or a perennial is after its harvest, after you've harvested the fruit, before the leaves fall off. That's the time you're going to get the most benefit in establishing the functioning biological system in the soil. What's the second most important time to be feeding that plant? I would suggest that's when the plant is probably going through its flowering and fruiting phase. John talked about that again yesterday. He said calcium and boron are critical to be adding to the plant, and probably silicon also when it's flowering. Between bud break and petal drop is a really good time to foliar calcium and boron. That'll help the hormonal system stay balanced. Anybody know about hormone imbalance? I would disagree. She said that she's heard that you're not supposed to spray anything on blossoms. And it's at that point when the blossoms are open and they're pollinating that the hormonal demand is really high. You're basically impregnating that tree, you know, 10,000 times. And she's, you know, she's going through that hormone shift majorly. And if she doesn't have enough calcium and boron to buffer, you know, the mineral needs, she'll, you know, hormonally go out of whack, get imbalanced, and then be tweaked while she's pregnant. Anybody? Know anybody like that? That's what happens to our plants. That's what happens to the tomatoes.
Don't feed them crap.
Don't feed them crap. No, feed them good food. But it happens. Same thing happens to the tomatoes. When you got 10 fruit filling at the same time, she's pregnant, right? She's hungry. And everyone's like, oh, well, they got sick and they died. Well, you weren't feeding her. She's hungry. And if she doesn't get enough food, she's pulling that food out of her bones to feed her babies. Anybody know about that? Teeth? Hips? Yeah, exactly. Okay, next topic. You should assert yourself, Derek.
Well, I was going to mention that we often do a foliar spray with pickles and peanut butter.
A little bit of ice cream. The question was about frost on... I don't remember what happened last year. So what are you, basically he's talking about frost resistance in the pollination period, right, when oftentimes the flowers, the buds break and, you know, the fruit is just about to set and we get a frost, or sometime in that range we get a frost and it kills all the fruit and everybody loses all their fruit that year. And what happens when your plants are healthy is they have a higher Brix reading, and so their frost temperature, you know, the temperature at which the sap freezes drops, and so you can make it through a 28 or 29 degree frost with no damage or minimal damage when everybody else loses their crop. Or if you have a very cold frost but you have lots of energy, the plant can actually flower again and you know, go through the process again if it has sufficient reserve energy. And what's that? Which is when the post-harvest feeding is so important, because that's when you can help that plant build the sugar and store the energy in the roots for the winter. Ever look at an apple tree in the spring when it's flowering? It's like the leaves have just broken. Like all that energy is being used and there's no leaf or very, very little leaf, which means no photosynthetic activity, which means she's running totally on stored energy, right? That whole process is being done on stored energy. Think about it. A little bit of help, you know, in getting them in a good place in the winter really helps them out in the spring. The next topic is appropriate for you, Derek.
So the next question is on nutrient availability in wet, poorly drained soils, also aerobic versus anaerobic bacteria in very wet soils and high levels of iron in very wet soils. So who was responsible for that question? Do you want to expand any more? Is it?
Sometimes in the spring when we're, you know, allowing
Yeah. All right, so unfortunately, this is something I have a little bit of experience on because we also work really wet soils. And certainly, you're smelling sulfur, and that's sort of a good sign that you've gone anaerobic. So we sort of, practically speaking, think about this in a couple things. One is, from a biological perspective, it's one of the reasons that we do a lot of inoculations of our soils on a regular basis. And the thought there is that, you know, when you've gone anaerobic for a period of time, that's probably shut down the biology. So for us, you know, that can be, you know, that might manifest like this. Maybe we get a warm spring and we're tilling and getting stuff out in the ground in late April, and then all of a sudden we get hit. You know, a couple years ago we had, you know, 5-6 inch rainstorms in May, and all of a sudden the soils that seemingly were going to be dry and going to be great have all of a sudden gone wet. So we will, after that period of time, and even right away, basically make sure we're doing a couple things. One is feeding the plant to make sure it's alive through a wet, saturated soil state. That's the worst case scenario, but if it's sitting in water, you have to think of it as hydroponics for a short period of time. And then two is to come back and re-inoculate with biology to make sure that any of the biology that's been killed off has a chance to recolonize. What happens with wet soils is, specifically, there's iron can be reduced and becomes more aerobic, as does manganese and some of the other trace minerals. And ultimately, that's where we would say make sure you're adding phosphorus to that photosynthesis, because iron can get tied up, can tie up phosphorus in your leaf. So there you are, you're having a problem with that might show up. So.
Can I say a couple things too?
Yeah, I think the only other thing for us is that long term, you want to think about, kind of like you were just talking about with energy with perennial systems, is you want to think about how are we going to make that system as resilient to deal with that reality that you're going to have these periods over time. So that's where, you know, long term, continuing to build that humus structure through that fungal digestion, if you want to go that direction, is going to make a bigger difference. And for us, we do that partially also with our drive strips. We till everywhere on the farm, but we have drive strips every 60 feet with partially that idea that you're having a place for recolonization of microbes and things that would be damaged by tillage. And that's, you know, going towards a permanent bed system, of course, would be even better, but we haven't been able to take that on.
Yeah, there's a couple things with compaction. Do you know, are you just in a low spot, or do you have compaction in your subsoil?
We just don't have a lot of soil. There's bedrock underneath of us.
It's straight bedrock. Okay. And that's a flat bedrock, or it's, so you got a hole in the middle, or?
You know, it'll come in on one point of the field, so mm-hmm. The edge of the field will be really wet, so, you know.
Yep. There's an angle to the field.
Well, we have, like, 10 to fill in the field. Some
yep.
of them have angles, and some of them
are kind of flat. I mean, my experience is that if you have a bed that's just 4 inches higher than a pathway, that, you know, you can keep an aerobic zone in the top couple of inches that will be drier and plantable, but that tilling or plowing in the spring is generally a bad idea, and especially when the soil's wet, is absolutely against the rules. That's like a big slap on the hand. Do not plow when the soil's wet. Everybody know that? That's big no-no. Some, you know, old farmers know that, obviously, but young farmers don't necessarily know that you can do a lot of damage by tilling up wet soil. If you had subsoil issues, I would suggest perhaps some of the deeper-rooted cover crops, or perhaps, you know, doing some ripping with a yeoman's plow or something like that, keyline plow, to open up a... Oftentimes people will have a plow pan where the soil is compacted 8 inches down or 10 inches down. That's not your issue. But I think permanent raised beds where you don't need to till much to prepare the bed in the spring is the best opportunity. So prepare your beds in the fall, and if you've got an angle to the land, even a minor angle to the land, and you know this area is oftentimes wet, then put your pathways on the angle so the water will drain out in the pathways. Last fall, the year we had Rita and Irene, we got about, there were 13 or 14 inches of rain. It was a lot of rain in about a week. And we had rivers running through the field every 4 feet. I mean, there was a current of water flowing through every 4 feet. And I had just planted my baby greens in between. I planted after Irene before Rita, I planted, you know, a bunch of mescaline and arugula and stuff, and they germinated, you know, in the middle of an 8-inch rainstorm, and were up and growing thereafter, and the water just ran right out at a very light angle. So raised beds can do a lot of good benefit, and if you put them in place in the fall, then you only need to till the top inch. You can really do some good systemic solutions that will improve things.
I'm just going to add one thing, which is, so we decided first year we're going to deal with this. We did raised beds. The second year we said, oh, well, let's try some subsoiling to see if we can get the drainage, but we didn't do raised beds that year. And indeed, for us anyways, it has to be both of those things. It can't just be the tillage, depending on what your water table is. And it's kind of like I just said, where we're leaving that place where we're not plowing, is that even, you know, with a nice raised bed, and the bigger you could go on that soil, the better. It just at least keeps that biotic zone at the very tip of that, no matter how saturated this gets, able to start to recolonize if this goes anaerobic.
And the one other thing I would say is that I like to look at the lay of the land and see where the low point is, and that's a great spot to dig out a pond. A pool, you know, I don't know if it's 20 feet across or 10 feet across or 50 feet across, but if the land is wet and you've got a low spot in the middle of a field, dig it out. And, you know, permaculture style, put in all your perennials around it, but let the water flow, and then you can use that as a water source. You know, you can actually irrigate your field from that spot in the middle of the field later if you want. I know that Derek has a great spot for that in his field. I was like, Derek, you need to put a pond right there. It would be great. Some people have problems with the town, like, you know, if you want to just dig up a hole in the ground, then you have to ask them first, but depending on where you live, you can just do it.
I just add that if you have a wet field, get your calcium levels to excellent, because calcium has a tendency to loosen the rock in the soil, allowing moisture to penetrate.
If you've got a wet field, get your calcium levels up, because calcium has a, you know, is known to flocculate and loosen up the soil, which will allow water to flow down if it's compact. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Examples of deep-rooted cover crops. Rye is one of my favorites of all time. I think it's profoundly vigorous. The forage radish is another one that goes down deep and cracks the soil open and leaves a bunch of, you know, rots in there, which is all like food for bacteria to, you know, just multiply like crazy. So, yeah.
I think yes. Yellow blossom sweet clover for wet fields as well as one of the good taproots.
Cool. Yep.
You haven't mentioned worms this weekend. I wonder where they fit in this. Are they just an indicator species or
a I mentioned them quickly in passing in discussing mulch. My experience is when I mulch my soil well that the worm population is very high, and I'm a big fan of lots of worms. I think keeping the soil covered and keeping the soil moist, keeping sufficient organic material in the soil for the, you know, all those soil people to digest and eat is critical. If you have bare soil, if you, you know, bare cultivate, don't mulch, things like that, you're going to have a much lower worm population. I generally consider them to be very positive, and I find that mulching is a great way to get very high levels of them. Yep. Sheet composting, I think, is a good strategy. I think if you knew what the soil underneath the sheet composting did not have, and you're able to put that down before you started the sheet composting, that would be a good strategy. But minimizing the disturbance, minimizing your disturbance of the soil when you're, you know, converting it from a lawn or a pasture to crops is great. Inoculate cover crops, yes. And foliar spraying the cover crops. If you're going to put your cover crops in, you know, September 1st or September 15th, and they're going to grow for a good month and a half, applying a foliar spray or two onto them is money very well spent for next year's crop. And if those cover crops are overwintering cover crops like rye, doing a foliar spray or two on them in the spring is money well spent. If you're doing what? If you're foliar spraying the cover crops?
You're doing just after
I would probably wait until they're 6 inches tall and then maybe do it again at 12 or 18 inches.
I could just take that. I'm going to probably be doing a workshop at the NOFA Summer Conference on this whole idea of residue digestion, kind of thinking about that circulation, and the folks that have heard me speak in Dan's course have heard me talk about this. So functionally what that looks like for us on our farm is we use a flail mower to chop up any residue. So imagine what had happened this year was we decided we were going to take our tomatoes down. It was September 15th or 16th, and early morning kids, crew started cutting down twine and taking the twine up and pulling out the metal stakes, and we ran through with the flail mower. And then as soon as we did that, we sprayed on a digestion spray, which is a beneficial microbe mix, plus molasses and phosphorus and things to kind of feed that biology. Tilled it in, you know, maybe just a couple inches deep, seeded our winter rye, did a spray of that rye before the rye got tilled in. And then after that rye is established, about a week in, we did a third final spray. So basically doing everything we can to basically take advantage of the fact that it's mid-September, there's still a lot of growing season to it, and we could get that rye going. And we had just lush, I mean, we seeded pretty thickly because we've had poor germination in the past with cover crops because of the wet soils. But our rye was just, you know, beautiful by mid-October. And then we'll follow up with some foliars in the spring before we turn it in.
Whenever you get around to it. Anybody else? Yes.
Yeah, I'd almost say that the cheap composting, but I heard about lasagna gardening too. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I could speak to the differences between sheet composting and lasagna.
But I think generally what you're talking about is creating some sort of substrate to have mycelium kind of saturate that and then using that as inoculum for the rest of your garden. So, I mean...
And minimizing tillage, you know, converting your grasslands to cropland by while not tilling, which is a good idea. Next topic. Latest best advice for heavy metal remediation in soil.
It's probably for John. From you, for John?
Wait for John. Biotello or hay, which is better? Biotello, which is a biodegradable corn-based black plastic, which is GMO, I think.
Yeah.
It's not GMO? It used to be GMO? What was the big deal about it?
I don't know. It's certified.
Okay, corn-based black plastic versus hay, which is better?
From a commercial vegetable grower's perspective, I'd say, what crop am I growing? If I'm trying to grow a melon crop and trying to grow a pepper crop, I'd go black plastic hands down if you have all the equipment for laying the mulch and so on and so forth.
It's going to be cheaper and less effort to put the black plastic down. I don't think you're going to get the benefit from the black plastic in the biology of the soil from that you would get from hay.
And this is, I think, insightful for some of the home gardeners that are like, oh, maybe I'd like to use plastic or whatever. But, you know, we often will run trials where we're, say, split eggplant planting, some on plastic, some without. And functionally, you see much better yields oftentimes on plastic. The disadvantage is you can't do things like undersowing. So this past year, we had all of our eggplants without plastic, but we were able to put a nice clover crop. So, you know, right now where our cabbage is going to get planted in June, there's a beautiful clover stand. So.
Cool.
You can see some of the benefit of plastic if you have very black compost.
Mm-hmm.
So the heat gathering potential can be almost as good. So if you have, you know, a thick layer of excellent colored compost will give you that heat that the plastic does.
Sure.
Biodegradable
corn-based black plastic. Yes. Theoretically, you don't need to pull it up. You got more biodynamic background than I do.
So the backstory for me was if you back up to 2004 and 5, I was farming on Martha's Vineyard where my wife grew up. And after we decided to leave the island, one of the things that I was sort of really interested in investigating for myself was how can I wean myself off of bagged fertilizers, because it just sort of felt like it was this weird thing where we're just trying to be organic and we're buying in all this bagged fertilizer. So I had the blessed opportunity to work with the fine folks at Hawthorne Valley. I was one of the vegetable managers there for two seasons. And partially I was trying to go and kind of investigate something that intrigued me, which is that whole idea of closing the fertility loop. And a couple things. First off, if you read the agricultural lectures that Steiner gave, there is in those agricultural lectures pretty strong language that says it is okay to bring things in from elsewhere for remediation efforts, for sort of bringing in, recharging, re-energizing. So I don't feel like if you're, you know, hardline biodynamic person, you're not going to necessarily say you can't bring soft rock phosphate in, or you can't bring manganese or boron or things like that. The piece that gets that I sort of still hold on to, we do a lot of work with preps on the farm, and there's sort of a couple things that I really appreciate about the biodynamic intent, which is one, of course, is the farm individuality and the thought that every farm, garden, or space has its own kind of inherent being, and you have to honor that. And so, you know, one solution for what works here is not going to work over there, and that might be, you know, vastly different over distances. And the second is, and I think I actually have a book over here, which is just Pfeiffer's Introduction to Biodynamics. And I just started reading this book last year, and it was a book that I sort of kicked myself that I didn't get exposed to when I was at Hawthorne Valley, because in it he makes some pretty compelling arguments for the biological impact that using biodynamic preps have. And so one of the things that we're going to be doing this year is we use barrel compost on the farm. It's Maria Thune's recipe. It's cow manure and basalt and eggshells. And Pfeiffer did research where he was taking barrel compost and prepping one of the barrels with biodynamic preps and not prepping the other one, and looking at what the maturity date and the speed of all that maturity was. And at the base of it, all these biodynamic preps, whether it's the you know, yarrow or dandelion or things like that, when they're going through their period of maturity, they're actually involving a lot of biology in that maturation. And so when you're using those preps in your farm, you can think of them sort of as biological inoculants for the farm. And then you can, of course, get into the energetics and things like that. So I think there's, you know, you did a course at Hawthorne Valley last year.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of openness. There's certainly going to be some hardliners within the biodynamic movement. But I think that's shifted a lot over the years. Personally, I'd say Jean-Paul Cortens was on the board, and when I started at Hawthorne Valley, that was the furthest thing from what the BD Association would have felt comfortable with, because everybody thought, you know, he was a big vegetable grower, and could he be biodynamics when he's cropping 100 acres and using Chilean nitrate and things like that.
Yeah, I think I've had some experience with various people in the Biodynamic Association, to sort of, you know, people, important people, not just real people, and quote unquote, right? And there's certainly a significant understanding among them that this is an important piece of the puzzle. And Steiner used his, you know, flowery language to talk about the various different kingdoms and the etheric realm, and there was the mineral realm. And they happen to have been focusing on other realms, and they're like, oh, maybe we should pay attention to the mineral realm for a little bit. I'm like, yeah, why don't we all work together and see if we can figure this out? I like the biodynamic people because they have, almost by definition, an openness to subtle forces and energies. I think Derek's point about the inoculant function of the preps is very important. A well biodynamically inoculated compost pile is oftentimes a really good compost. Not always, but certainly it's I think it has a lot of biological effect in the preps. I mostly take from the biodynamic perspective the planting calendar. I think that there's a lot of importance or opportunity to make things easier for yourself. If you're planting your greens on a leaf day and you're, you know, planting your tomatoes on a fruit day, and if the calendar says don't, you know, plant things today, or this is a good day to kill things, don't, you know, go out and transplant. Weed on a day when you should kill things, but don't transplant. There's a lot of subtle forces out there. My understanding is, you know, indigenous cultures around the planet are all very, very specific about what days you do things and what days you don't do things based on where the moon stands. And I know Steiner didn't lay that out exactly. Maria Thun was involved in discerning a lot of that information, but I certainly pay a lot of attention to the biodynamic planting calendar, and you know that's my calendar. Everything, my entire life is on the biodynamic planting calendar. So I'm not sure if that's...
Yeah, we still use the calendar on our farm when it's convenient, basically, in the sense of, you know, we're not necessarily going to follow it to a T, but we're going to use it as a guideline. For folks that are interested on the research side of things, there's actually a little bit renewed effort within the BD Association to do research. So if you're sort of curious about planting on root days, so on and so forth, get in touch with me, because there's a guy who's coordinating research efforts to kind of... Because some of Maria's research hasn't necessarily been always holding true to what she developed. So it's sort of one of those things they're constantly looking at.
Yeah.
From an energetic perspective, we didn't talk about this as much yesterday, and we didn't talk about foliar sprays yet, but we do a lot of energizing of any of our sprays that we're putting out over the farm, and that's something that I came with me from the biodynamic community when we're often stirring preps for an hour in the springtime, and we're spraying horn manure and things like that. So we're doing foliar sprays on a weekly basis. When we really are on top of things, we're spending even a 15 or 20 minute time stirring that spray before it goes out on the field and trying to basically take that energetics that's within that and bring that to the entirety of the water, and then hopefully that energetics gets spread out.
There's a lot of tools and things you can buy that will do that for you, or you can do it yourself, which is probably better. But the act of getting your water to spin in a vortex is very, very important. You can do a lot of benefit by getting your water to do things like that. I would love to be able to understand that better, and I don't yet. Perhaps we could ask John. I know John is... knows a lot about these kinds of things. So if you want to ask about stirring and energizing and things, he's very, very experienced.
So you can like stir it and then like sort it.
Yes. Exactly. Or you can get a little, you know, get a little vortex brewer, you know, a compost tea brewer that's got a vortex. It's a big vortex, and it's constantly, you know, doing this to the water. That I talked in the, before lunch about energizing water, getting it to spin in that vortex seems to have a lot of benefits. I can't speak to it intelligently more than that personally. Yes, basalt. Well, the basalt has paramagnetic charge, among other things. As well as having 45 different minerals, which is 3/4 of the 60 John said we need, it has that charge. And I tell you, I had this arugula, $2,500 on an 84-foot bed. And I, you know, what did I do more there than anything else? I put a ton of basalt down there. Probably literally a ton, which isn't really that much. When you start getting the shovel out. Yes? How can you energize water that you're putting through your drip line? Or your hose or your whatever? I got various people are working on that. I don't know. I mean, all these vortexing things, you can get inline tools that you can hook into a hose or hook onto a irrigation pipe that will spin your water, put it through a vortex form inline, you know, under pressure. There's a whole bunch of tools out there, and I'm not knowledgeable enough personally to be able to say this is a good buy, this was a, you know, fraud. You can pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars. You can pay $50. There's some interesting things out there, but yeah. If for people who are interested, it's a you know, if you're going to buy toys that might have value, that's a good toy that might have value. Is a water structure or energizer, I would say, especially if you do a lot of irrigation. Yes, Catherine. Yes. What's the role of animals in our systems? even. She said specifically the role of chicken manure. I think chickens are amazing. Chicken manure is a really powerful material. I like to not buy my chicken manure, but have a chicken tractor that runs over the field as a part of the, you know, annual cycle of things. when we bought our farm 4 years ago, there was not much odor in the soil. It just, you know, it was hard, it was tight, and not much smell to it. And we ran our chickens back and forth a couple times, and it's transformational. We just got a field across the street, and that's one of the first things I'm going to do is run chickens back and forth across that field. You can really build a life up rapidly with chicken manure. My personal opinion. It's high, it's hot, right? Lots of nitrogen, so don't do it excessively. And if you're going to be certified organic, you need to have 90 or 120 days after the chickens run over before you can harvest a crop off that field. If you're certified organic, you need to have either 90 or 120 days after the chicken manure is applied before you can, or the chickens are there eating and pooping before you can harvest a crop. For fruiting crops, it's 90, and it's all 120 for everything?
It's underground. If it's in the ground, it's 120. If it's aerated,
it's above ground, it's 90, yeah. Like tomatoes and things like that, there's 90, yeah.
What's your feeling about the chicken manure that gets pelleted with the
vaccine? I don't have any experience with it.
Well, we use, you know, bagged chicken manure, and I think there's a lot of commercial growers that do. And in addition to its nutrient content, any of the manure-based fertilizers tend to have organic acids that help to digest some of the rock minerals that we're working with. So, there's a lot of different products out there, and some of them might work better than the others. And there's always the, you know, philosophical question about dealing with, you know, a large-scale feeding operation and what their waste product is. But, you know, there's a lot of options for nitrogen out there. I can pick on Julie because she's in the front row. Julie uses linseed oil, right? For nitrogen?
Linseed meal.
Just a little
bit, yeah.
Just a little bit. And I didn't know anything about linseed meal, so I started looking at it a little bit because I was curious. And a good portion of the flax crop in the United States, they use Roundup to desiccate the crop before they harvest it. And so, you know, if you look at any sort of situation out there, unless it's all within your system, odds are it's not perfect. And you're going to have to figure out where and what are you willing to have compromises with.
And bone meal comes from cows fed GM grain, and blood meal and feather meal. From my perspective, you know, I don't have any experience with it, A, because we talked about my perspective on nitrogen. You should not need to add it, is my basic answer. And that's money that you could spend on systemically addressing your underlying issues, which are causing you to need nitrogen in the first place. So perhaps as a crutch for a couple of years, but there's a lot of money and industry and profit involved in selling nitrogen to farmers, and there are how many hundreds of tons, maybe just dozens of tons of nitrogen above every acre on the planet. We have plenty in our environment, and if we have to buy it, and it's a major fertility cost, from a biological perspective, something's broken. You should not need to do it.
But, I mean, there is a time thing here. You do need to synthesize proteins for the soil biology to make nitrate from. So you can need protein. You can be short of protein unless you have a nitrogen-fixing plant that can access elemental nitrogen from the air. You are going to need that protein. And chickens are one of the ways to synthesize.
And I'm going
to
argue that all plants in nature have the relationship with nitrogen-fixing bacteria on their leaf surface, not just legumes. All plants have the functional capacity to fix nitrogen when they have the critical bacteria and fungi in the environment and the critical trace elements that are the core of the enzymes that are used to do it. If you don't have molybdenum in your soil, you don't have the nitrogenase enzyme, and you can't fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. If you do have molybdenum, then you can have the nitrogenase enzyme, and you can fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. But all the nitrogen that's going washing down the Mississippi and creating all those dead zones is not necessary. And if you want to take out Monsanto and all those big corporate interests, help your farmers get functional biological systems, and they won't need nitrogen fertilizer anymore. I'm talking about every single plant, tomatoes and cucumbers and broccoli and, you know, think about it for a second. In nature, who is adding nitrogen fertilizer? Are there legumes? Is every plant a legume? Or where is this nitrogen being fixed from? The microbiology happens to be very clear on this topic. All plants have the capacity to set up symbiotic relationships on their leaf surface with bacteria and fungi that can fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. And if they're not fed lots of nitrogen when they're young, in the same way when you feed lots of soluble phosphorus, you shut down the mycorrhizae. If you don't feed lots of nitrogen, but you provide the bacteria and the mineralogical environment, the plant will automatically set up that dynamic and begin to feed the biology that will fix its nitrogen for it. That's nature's path, to my understanding. And when John comes back, he can, you know, talk more in more detail. He knows more about the microbiology specifically.
And just to build on that, I mean, if you want to go into the, I want to buy something and fix nitrogen, the Zotobacter, there's a lot of different inoculant companies out there. Blooming Blossoms is one of those that sells a company that produces an Azotobacter that's supposed to be well suited for across ranges of pH, and they also function in fixed nitrogen down to like 40 degrees. For them to do that, they either need to have molybdenum or vanadium as their enzyme yes. cofactors. So it is, it's concert of minerals and biology.
And you get that vanadium from your local basalt. Right. You get your vanadium from the local basalt. You need molybdenum or vanadium.
Oh, the product's name is Blooming Blossoms, but I mean, there's a lot of other. If you look for Azotobacter inoculants, the Blooming Blossoms, it was developed in India, and they you know, pride and joy is that it can work across spectrum of soils. But there's a lot of other Azotobacter inoculants.
It's Azotobacter is a species of bacteria that fixes nitrogen, and specifically is a symbiote. People most well know it for being a symbiote with the legumes, peas and beans and things like that. Derek said yesterday that there's 1 million pounds of molybdenum that are used in agriculture every year.
Yeah.
And that they mix, and it's used to be mixed with those Azotobacters as part of the seed coat for your legumes.
No, the Azotobacters actually are cross species. Beyond legumes, they actually right. work more in the grasses. So
okay.
the rhizobia are the bacteria that work with the legumes. This is a non-leguminous. It's basically a free-floating bacteria in your soils. We probably, almost everybody here, likely has a Azotobacter in their soils. They just tend to function or not function well, depending on all of what we've just been talking about.
You can have Azotobacter present in your soil, but if you don't have molybdenum or vanadium, they cannot fixed nitrogen, because the enzyme that's used to do it, the nitrogenase enzyme, is built out of molybdenum or vanadium. So you have to have the species present and the minerals present, and when you do, all of your crops can do this naturally, is the point. And this is a point where I usually bring up the topic of cobalt. 80% of the species of bacteria need cobalt to exist. And if you don't have cobalt, the same way when we don't have B12, we're anemic and we can die. If the soil life doesn't have cobalt, they'll get anemic and die. So you don't just need to have the molybdenum, you need to have the cobalt too. So basically what it comes down to is you need a very broad spectrum of trace elements in small quantities. And after you're done with your macros, your copper and your zinc and your calcium and your potassium, get a bunch of stone dust, you know, go for a trip to the ocean, fill up a barrel of seawater, get some broad spectrum minerals and put them out in the soil, because they're critical for that biological system function.
Just to clarify, from what I understand, Nitrosomonas and Nitrobacter are present in soils to oxidize fixed nitrogen. They don't, in fact, fix atmospheric nitrogen, but then oxidize it to nitrate. Mm-hmm. Nitrate.
Yep.
You may have done more research on this than I have in that sense, but I know one of the products they're marketing is a specific phylloplane inoculant for leaf inoculant. So in that regard, I think they are actually saying that it can, you know, basically be concentrating nitrogen through its body metabolism, but I couldn't say, I mean...
My understanding is it's happening on the leaf surface, that the primary place where this occurs, if you want to harvest your own nitrogen-fixing inoculants, that's when you go to the tree and pull some of that moss or, you know, lichen off the north side of the tree. That's the fruiting body of nitrogen-fixing fungi that are symbiotically established to that tree and that fix nitrogen from the atmosphere to feed to the tree. We can harvest from our own natural environments a lot of these spore forms of these species and apply them on our crops if we so choose. You can buy them or you can harvest them. But out in the forest, nobody's adding nitrogen and is being fixed out of the atmosphere to feed our plants. And that's part of nature's system. When John comes back, we can ask him the details on the subject. But I think it's pretty well solid science on that one.
I'm just going to add for the commercial growers in the room that I would actually be very hesitant to recommend cutting yourself off cold turkey from nitrogen.
Yes.
If you've been using nitrogen over the past, because odds are your biology isn't going to be there. So, you know, wean yourself slowly. Don't necessarily go cold turkey.
John just came. We're having a debate about nitrogen fixation, John. Can you serve as a mediator? The judge, yes. The topic is nitrogen fixation, bacteria, phylloplane, non-legumes. Do you have any?
Sure. Instead of talking about the science of it, I'll just share a story. So when we first began experimenting with microbial inoculants 7-8 years ago, I tried a lot of different things, a lot of different compost teas, compost tea extracts, compost tea brews from a variety of manufacturers, and also we were experimenting with different applied microbial inoculants, including the tinea microbials. So the story that I'd like to share specifically relates directly to one of the tinea products called Spectrum. Actually, we were using Biogenesis, which contains the same microbial species as the Spectrum does, but they have a little bit more horsepower, a little bit more food to help them establish a strong population. So in spring of, I want to say it was 2006, spring of 2006, we had a very dry spring. We were growing a rye cover crop to plant our cantaloupe in our cantaloupe field, and it was so dry, the rye pulled out a lot of the moisture, and we were not able to get in to plow and incorporate our cover crop and prepare for planting as we wanted to. So the when the rye had completely matured and had already fully hit it out, was 5.5-6 feet tall, mature, lignified, we finally got about 3/4 inch of rain. And we had the cantaloupe plants were already a little bit stressed. They were already stressed in the greenhouse. We'd had them in the greenhouse for a week longer than we wanted to because we weren't able to get into the field. So we had this very high carbon residue, very low nitrogen content. I was concerned about nitrogen availability for the following crop. So we sprayed the cover crop of rye with Spectrum and Pepzyme before we incorporated it. So we plowed it down, and 3 days after we finished plowing, we were done transplanting cantaloupe. We plowed it upside down, we tilled it, we played plastic, raised beds, plastic mulch, drip irrigation, and planted the cantaloupe 3 days later. And I was quite concerned that the decomposing rye residue was going to tie up a lot of the nitrogen and a lot of the nutrients from the following crop. So we also put in Biogenesis and Pepzyme into the transplant solution when we planted the cantaloupe. So those were all according to Tinio's instructions. However, I thought that if these things are this good at digesting this material, then I'm concerned about the nitrogen fixation, and I wanted it to happen even a little bit faster. So I did a weekly application for the next 4 weeks through the irrigation system of 1 ounce of Pepzyme, which is not an inoculant, but is simply a microbial stimulant. So these plants grew very vigorously, very nicely. They appeared to be very healthy. And then when they began blossoming, in producing cantaloupe, we always want to set the king blossom, the crown set. And when we set all the crowns set, we not only have very healthy cantaloupe, but we have all the cantaloupe on the plastic rather than off the row in the soil and in the mud. So I was keeping track of what was happening with the King Blossom. Well, the King Blossom all completely aborted, 100%. We didn't get a single fruit set. So I became a little intrigued with what was going on. And at about the same time, we had a very severe infestation of cucumber beetles. So I took soil analysis and I took plant tissue analysis and sent them into the laboratory. And the tissue analysis report came back 8% nitrogen content. And the soil report came back 1,200 pounds per acre, no, 800 pounds per acre of nitrate nitrogen, which is, both of those numbers are ridiculous. There's no such thing as having numbers that high. So I retook the samples and sent them to the laboratory again. There was about 5 days between the first set and the second set of samples. The second set of samples came back, the reports were identical, and the soil laboratory report called me up and said, hey John, we don't know what's going on here, because actually on both samples, I had called them in and asked them to rerun the data because I didn't believe the test. So they reran the samples, came back with the same report. They reran the second set of samples twice until the lab technician from the soil lab called me back and says, hey John, we don't know what's going on here, but it's nothing that we're doing. He said the soil analysis only goes up to 800 pounds per acre. It could be 1,000 or 2,000. We're only going to show 800 pounds per acre. So that is a story in real life of microbes' capacity to fix nitrogen without any need for legumes. There's quite a variety of specific microbial strains that do that. Azotobacter, Pseudomonas fluorescens, Trichoderma. There's quite a few different microbial populations that will fix and sequester nitrogen without legumes. And they can do it in tremendous, tremendous quantities.
The allelopathic effect of tilling under the rye and then planting rapidly thereafter. Were you concerned about that?
Typically, I find that the allelopathic effect of rye is not nearly as strong when it has been incorporated as it is when it's actually growing and immediately after the seed has been planted. So I wasn't tremendously concerned about that. We already had the transplants. We weren't trying to germinate a seed. So we put the transplants in and they took off and grew very, very well.
Jeremy?
This was 2006 was the year, it was the first year we went completely chemical free. So we were still, the learning curve was just starting really steep at that point. So the King Blossom aborted because we had a very high nitrogen content. And there was too much nitrogen, so all the King Blossom aborted. We worked very, very hard with I put a lot of dedicated effort into that crop using high applications of magnesium. Magnesium is kind of the antidote to nitrogen. So I did a lot of very aggressive foliar applications of magnesium applications in the irrigation system, applications of complete humic substances to try to sequester that nitrogen and take some of that nitrogen out of the system. We did eventually get a crop off of those plants, but it was easily 3 weeks later than what it should have been because we lost the first three sets off of those plants thanks to the high protein content, high nitrogen content.
There was another question for you. We waited, saved for you. Latest best advice for heavy metal remediation in soil.
So instead of using the words heavy metals, I would refer to them as toxic elements. So that could include arsenic and cadmium. There's a couple of different things that we can do with them, sequester them, digest them, transmute them. Transmutation of these elements and transmutation of radioactive isotopes both happens in soils that have very high levels of biological activity. And I heard Dan earlier today mention the Lübke farm in Austria after Chernobyl. And essentially, the government could not find any radiation on that farm, even while the radiation was still dropping. They were still having fallout 24/7 when they were there testing. The peak had passed, but they were still having fallout, and they could not find any radiation in the soils, in any of the plants, or in the milk, which is typically, since dairy animals are eating a lot of forages and are concentrating that, typically it is very concentrated in milk. They could not find any radioactive isotopes in the milk. So a lot of these compounds can be either sequestered or transmuted through biological activity. The best thing that we can do, for biology to do this, they need both a strong foundation and a strong buffering system to help them buffer that out, and that can be provided with complete humic substances. So providing humic materials in the form of leonardite or humates or something like that will give them the environment that they need to take these elements out of the system.
And some food?
Humic substances are stable humic substances because they can decompose no further, so they themselves are not a food source.
So they need some food also?
But they need some food. They do need a food source, yes.
Like molasses and...
Like rejuvenate, the molasses, cover crop residues, compost.
Complete humic substances, that's humates, either in a liquid form or a dry form. The smaller the particle size, the more the availability, A. And food for the microbes, molasses would be a good source.
Yep.
And seawater is nice for its broad-spectrum mineral component.
Yes, it has a lot of trace minerals and enzyme cofactors, so it's going to stimulate the enzymatic system. So, yes, that would be good.
And a nice inoculant.
Yes.
Good enough, Julie? Humus will form in your soil if you've got a nice fungal digestion. Yes. Effectively, every humic compound is like a snowflake. It's shaped differently. So no, it's the same thing. You can bring them in, you know, by the bag or by the dump truck load if you want, or you can build them on your soil. And the most strategic way, I would say, among other things, to, you know, reverse CO2 in the atmosphere, you know, increases in the atmosphere, is to build carbon in the soil through healthy functioning soil ecosystems. So yes, you can buy them in or you can build them on your soil. If you spend the money on fertility to, if you were going to spend $400 on humates and you instead spent that $400 on stimulating the biological system, you would probably fix a dramatically more carbon from the atmosphere, so get a better benefit strategically. Feedlot animals?
Yeah, that's getting, it's gotta be, you know, coming towards farms through manures and whatnot. Does that have any effect on biological activities in the soil?
I'm sure it does. I don't have any specific information. The question is there any data on the effect of antibiotics fed to animals coming through the manure affecting crops and soil life? I think the effect is more dramatic with Roundup.
I mean, there's definitely data in it coming through the manure. I think the University of Minnesota did some of that with pig manure, looking at potato crops, for example, and showing the potato crops had actually absorbed those compounds. But I don't know from an impact on the biology what that really was.
Anybody who's going to be getting in a manure from off-site, I think, should be paying close attention to where it's coming from and everything that those animals were fed. From a personal standpoint, I don't know the numbers. Is it 3 tons of cow manure per acre or 6 tons of cow manure per acre? Is a double dose of Roundup?
Well, essentially, all poultry manure today contains a pint of Roundup per ton, and dairy manure just a little bit, about half that, 8 ounces per ton.
So if you're not getting manure from organically fed animals, you are applying Roundup to your fields, among other things. So, you know, from my perspective, it's a very touchy subject, bringing in manures and how those compounds are breaking down and their effect in your system.
My comment on the question on the antibiotics would be that there definitely is a very strong, although largely unquantified, impact on antibiotics that antibiotics have coming through the manure on the soil microbial community. Antibiotics are designed to do what? Annihilate bacteria. And they do come through in manure. They do annihilate bacteria and other microbial populations in the soil system. Dung beetles typically tend to start disappearing, not only when we use antibiotics, but especially when we begin using parasiticides. The dung beetle population pretty much crashes. There is very little research out there because there is nobody to pay for the research. That's largely why it is unquantified.
No one's paying for that research to be done.
Nobody wants to know.
Yes. Nobody with money wants to know. I would suggest that you know the trump card is the soil life, and all these systemic issues are solved when your soil life community is functioning at a high level, and the way to get them to function at a high level is to provide them the environment and the environmental conditions where they can thrive. They need a broad spectrum mineral base. They need carbon. They need air. They need water, and they need food. And that food is primarily sugar, which means you should keep plants growing on this land as much as possible through the entire year, and you should get their BRICS readings as high as possible. If you can get an environment where those basic components are in place, you're going to have a high-functioning biological system, which is going to address systemically all these, you know, toxic pollutants. That would be a just sort of a categorical statement, sort of categorical. Ben, I'm not sure if John did. I don't know how antibiotics function.
Yeah.
So the question was on how antibiotics actually function in working against various life forms. I don't know the extensive details. I only know that Arden Anderson and Dr. George Kindness both told me that antibiotics work, their mode of action is as a chelation agent. And those are two authorities who I definitely trust to know what they are talking about. So I don't have the exact details behind the details. That's information that I'm just passing on.
Can I just, Bruce, and then we'll go off another one off the list?
So, essentially, to describe our farming operation today, where we are today, the practices then, the models that we use, and these continue to evolve over time. When we first began making the transition away from chemical use, we had four primary crops. We were growing tomatoes, cantaloupe, cucumbers, and zucchini for wholesale vegetable markets. We were also doing several smaller niche crops to complement those, green beans, pickling cucumbers, I'm sure there are others that I can't think of right now. But those four main crops, we were each growing about 2 to 2.5 acres apiece of those every year for roughly right around 10 acres of vegetables. Where we are today, we have a total of 15 tillable acres of land, and we do 10 acres in vegetables every year. So we split that into three different sections. We have one 5-acre section that is planted into early crops. The second 5-acre section is planted into late crops. The third 5-acre section is planted into cover crops for throughout the summer months. So we have a continual rotation of these three groups of crops. And the one more comment that I'd like to make is that of those total of 15 acres, 9 acres, or no, it's more than that, about 13 acres of that is land that we purchased for the first time. We had always been renting land, and we first purchased some of this additional land in October of 2010. And we had begun farming it, parts of it, a couple of years earlier, but most of it was first cousin to concrete. And so we are not yet at a level of overall plant health and performance that I would be comfortable completely removing the rotation. The crops that we are growing today, we are growing tomatoes are really the only crop that we were growing then that we're still growing large quantities of now. We have switched away from a wholesale market to more of a retail approach. Our primary market is a kind of a group CSA. We have one central coordinator. There's about a dozen farms working together to supply 3,500 member CSA. And our farm, my younger brother, who's a year younger than I am, is now running the farm for the last 2 years. And the primary crops that we are producing are tomatoes, salad greens, carrots, garlic, and onions. So we're no longer doing as many of the cucurbit crops. We still do small amounts of cantaloupe and watermelons, enough for us and the neighbors, pretty much. Not a whole lot more than that. So our crop group has changed very significantly. The models that we use are all based on plastic mulch and drip irrigation on all the crops that we do, even the garlic, the onions, the salad greens. And we do that, basically, we have 10 acres of these crops all together, producing a gross income right in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $27,000 per acre per year for the last 2 years. So there's been a very good income opportunity there. We have not been using a lot of straw and hay mulch, primarily for the reason that they have not been economically viable for us up to this point. And the last several years, it's been very difficult to buy straw and hay with limits that we've had in the marketplace. So that's kind of a description. Did that kind of answer your... I say plastic, and I shouldn't say plastic, because we are using a biodegradable film that is made out of cornstarch. So it's not actual plastic in and of itself. So when we are done with that crop, or in the case of the lettuce crops and greens crops, we'll typically either do multiple cuttings, or we will do, if it's a crop with a very vast, very quick turnaround, we might do two or three crops in that same bed. And then we'll go over it with a one-way disc, throw the soil apart, and completely incorporate the biodegradable film, and then plant a cover crop back into it. The question was, what do we do in our pathways? At this point, we simply do mechanical cultivation and cultivate it with a cultivator two or three times during the growing season. Yes?
If money was no object, do you think things grow better in biotello or in the hay mulch?
So the question is, do I think, if money was no object, do crops grow better in the biotello or do they grow better in hay mulch? I think for crops early in the spring where we want warm soil, the biotello is definitely going to warm the soil up faster and you're going to get a stronger start in the spring. The biotello does not do as good a job of conserving soil moisture as straw or hay mulch does, I don't believe, based on what we've experienced so far. Very carefully. So the question was, how do you plant second and third crops of greens into the biotello film? And we do it all by hand. We don't go through the first time through, we'll go through with a water wheel transplanter, plant everything using a water wheel transplanter. Second pass through, we'll go through, we'll do it by hand, we'll plant right into the same hole beside the plant that was already there. Yes? They're just about everything you can think of. Lettuce, head lettuce, leaf lettuce, arugula, bok choy, joy choy. I don't even know the names of everything. Mustard greens, beets, pretty extensive list. The only crops that are not grown on the biodegradable film would be carrots. I think carrots are it. We even plant beets on the biodegradable film because we really like what it does. Yes, we have our fertility program is typically a foliar application every 7 to 10 days, depending on the crop, the stage of growth, and my younger brother and very younger brother that are running the farm, my brother Ruben is now 16 years old, and he is doing all of the drip irrigation foliar applications. So we basically have a very general one-size-fits-all, similar to Dan's universal liquid feed, that we use for the drip irrigation system and for the foliar applications, and that gets used on all the crops all across the board. And we will supplement that above and beyond that with potassium or with calcium based on the different crops' critical points of influence. But it makes it easy for him to go out and fill up the sprayer, hitch up the team, and go spray 10 acres all at one shot. Yes? Are we still using a base fertilizer before we lay plastic? No, we are not. We are not using any dry fertilizers at all. Yes, our horsepower is limited to the four-footed kind. So we use horses to do all of our spraying, harvesting, planting, transplanting, tillage, everything. Oh yes, there is horse-drawn equipment of every size and kind that you can imagine. And if you need something, simply come to an Amish community somewhere, you'll find plenty. We can do anything with horses that you can do with a tractor. Quite literally. Yes. Is that question, I can repeat the question, is that question the amounts that you can put on limited by organic regulations?
By my saying slow and steady wins the race. I said 20 pounds per acre manganese sulfate is a safe target
yes.
per year. And then, but the issue is at that rate, it'll take a lot of people 30 years to get up to, you know, 80 or 90 ppm. So how do you do it faster if you want to?
I am very glad that you're making that recommendation that they only do 20 pounds per acre per year. And what you will find is that, and I've seen this over and over again, if there is any level of biological activity, you put on 20 pounds, see, soils are not linear. It's not a case of you put 20 pounds on, you get in your soil test increases by 20 pounds. On some soils, on dead Midwestern soils, you can put on 20 pounds and they might increase by 2 pounds or they might not increase at all. But on biologically active soils, we see it all the time where you can put on smaller quantities and much greater quantities will show up on your soil test than you've applied. 5 to 10 times greater sometimes. We see that happen a lot, and I think you should see that happen here in this region for most of the mineral that you're working with.
Sometimes things go up and sometimes they go down. Even when people add, you know, a good basic level of everything, but it seems like it's working. It'll work its way out. Yeah. I think is the answer.
It takes some time to cycle through, but it'll come through.
And if you get excited, and theoretically, yes. I don't think John knows what we're up to.
No, I don't.
People wanted to ask him questions. I thought I'd let him do it for a while. Are we gonna take a break, or are we gonna just go straight through till 5:30? Okay. You're still on, John.
We're only 35 miles away from Cleveland. So, yeah, Cleveland is the primary market. One more. That's it.
Last year you told a story about a farmer that wasn't growing GMO crops, got inadvertently sprayed with Roundup, and his crop resisted it. And couldn't figure out if you were implying that there's possible GMO contamination for soil microbes.
Okay, so the question is on a story that I shared last year and alluded to yesterday, I think, as well, on the farmer that I had worked with that had planted non-GM crops on soil that had GM crops planted into it in the past, and specifically corn or popcorn planted on soil that had 7 years of continuous GM corn planted on it previously, and that popcorn crop was then resistant to an application of Roundup. So what I am implying there is that we do have horizontal gene transfer happening from the plants that are growing on that soil down into the soil, the microbial population can then become genetically modified, and as there is documented evidence that we have horizontal gene transfer between all living organisms. So you have gene transfer from plants down into the soil microbes, and if that is intense enough, as in 7 years of straight corn, and all that corn residue, and then you plant popcorn back into it the next year, that DNA then transferred from the microbial community back into the popcorn, and now the popcorn was resistant to Roundup. The same happens to the our own digestive tract. There is now peer-reviewed scientific research that they have found genetically modified DNA in the blood and milk of dairy cattle, for example. When colony collapse disorder was rampant 3 to 4 years ago in the honeybees, Professor Kotz from Germany found genetically modified bacteria in the gut of the honeybees. So yes, I'm applying there that we have horizontal gene transfer. That leads me to another thought. I'm actually going to try to get this resource and the exact quote and get it for Ben, and then he perhaps can distribute it. But there is 6 weeks ago, there out of Germany, we have a peer-reviewed published article where they are now finding formaldehyde in genetically modified crops. The different analytical techniques and machines that we have, instruments that we have available to monitor the nutrient profiles of crops, they will look at different things. Some of them look at the various molecules and nutrients that are found, others look at chemical structures, but none of their analytical procedures has really been looking, would have detected formaldehyde for the last 15, 20 years that GMO crops have been widely used. So they believe that GMO crops have been producing formaldehyde all along, and they've only discovered it very recently. So I actually have a couple of slides that Don Huber sent me, and he stated that in the various corn crops that they tested in Iowa, they found formaldehyde in the GM crops at 200 parts per million. So to give you some idea of the perspective, the EPA toxic level for formaldehyde in water is 0.3 parts per million, and in food it is 0.6 parts per million. Formaldehyde is very carcinogenic, it's endocrine disrupting, it destroys the immune system, and all of those good things. So much more good news. All right, I think. What we are seeing is that if plants have complete enzyme nutrition and very high levels of energy, they can kick out that foreign DNA. And we believe the same with humans. Yes. All right. Talk to you more after break or at break.
Call it 3:50.